This is JLPT Bootcamp, the ultimate guide to passing the JLPT in less time with less pain. This is the JLPT Bootcamp podcast with your host, Mac. This is episode 138 of the podcast. This is a special cultural episode, just talking about what it's like to live in Japan and giving you some tips about some things to do, what to do, what not to do. I do one of these about once a month, and I have another one about once a month about studying for the test, what works, what doesn't work, studying for the JLPT. So, but this week I wanted to do something a little bit more fun. The last couple weeks, I felt like I've been doing a little bit of negative podcasts, kind of complaining about what it's like to have kids in Japan. And so I thought I'd change it up a little bit and do something fun. Talk about the top 10 things to do in Japan while you're here on vacation or while you're living here. Just things you need to experience that are uniquely Japanese. First one, number 10 on this list is karaoke boxes or clubs. I'm not sure how to describe them, but these are these karaoke joints where you can rent out a private room, and they're practically everywhere in Japan. If you're downtown, in any of the cities, major cities, all you need to really do is walk a few blocks at night and you will inevitably bump into someone handing out tissues, advertising for some big karaoke box. The big one here, like there's a Big Echo, there's Shidax, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. That's the name of the place. But there's a couple different chains that you can go to. They're all kind of interchangeable, to be honest. And they're not just for singing Japanese songs. You might think that you can't really enjoy it because it's all a bunch of Japanese songs, but a lot of the big chain karaoke places have a pretty wide selection of English songs as well. Admittedly, it's narrowed down to only the bands that are at least a little known in Japan. For example, you can get plenty of Queen and the Beatles, but I still haven't been able to find kind of some offbeat bands like Bare Naked Ladies, which is one of my favorite bands back in the States. So, which is kind of a bummer, but they do have even some hot new stuff. I mean, like a Lady Gaga or something would be probably loaded into those machines that you can rent out. And they're kind of cool because they have a couple different things. Like you can get, you can sing in these big, huge party rooms. They have these special packages and deals sometimes. For example, you can have an all-you-can-drink bar, which includes alcohol, or just soft drinks if you want to do it that way. And keep in mind that it's a private room. You're not singing in front of a big group of people. And two, there's also, we've been to a few, there's a place here in Osaka that has since shut down, but it used to be themed. So there used to be like all sorts of crazy stuff, like a performing disco room where there was like a stage that you could sing on, and there was like a hot tub room or something, which sounds really dangerous. You're using microphones in the hot tub. But there's a couple different, a lot of times these karaoke places, they're competing against other karaoke places which are very close by in the same area. And so they'll try some different gimmick. There was a place in downtown Osaka, in a place called Umeda, which is a really kind of uptown Osaka, so to speak. And in that area, there was actually a cosplay karaoke place where you could go, you get a costume and dress up and then sing in karaoke in your costume, all night, which was pretty cool. So if you look around, you can find some kind of interesting places to to sing at. And another cool thing is, if you really love singing and you are, I don't think you would do this if you're traveling to Japan, but if you live in Japan, you can usually go during the day, and these karaoke places have kind of like a free time that you pay a fairly small fee and you can just sing for a really long time. So if you want to just practice singing, or I mean, even if you are in Japan and you want to escape out of the rain or the scorching heat or something, in August, you can go in and sing for a few hours and get a few drinks in you and then go back out. So it's a good experience, and kind of unique to Japan. Other places obviously have karaoke boxes, but this is the birthplace of karaoke, so that's something you got to experience. And number nine is to stay at a love hotel. So if you don't know what a love hotel is, it's basically, you know, Japan is a crowded place. There's a lot of 20-somethings, 30-somethings, and probably a few 50-somethings that live with their folks, live with their parents, which makes it a little difficult to have some private time with a significant other. Luckily, Japan has a solution for that. It's these love hotels, which are these kind of mid-sized, usually themed hotel-ish places that offer a wide variety of experiences. I mean, there are Hello Kitty dominatrix themes, classic car themes, giant heart-shaped beds. There was one that we found the other day that was like a Santa Claus palace or something, that all the rooms were Christmas themed. So a lot of these are really ridiculously themed hotels. There's something for everyone. If you look long enough, you can find something that's just hilarious. That's just, I mean, even if you're not going there to, you know, do the deed, you just going there to kind of check it out and see what's available is really interesting. And a lot of these places, they have, you know, they're supplied with beer and other goodies, snacks, and, you know, all the things that you would need in that kind of situation. And they're relatively convenient in downtown areas, reasonably priced places to stay. Although they're not the cheapest place, that you can usually find a business hotel that's cheaper than one of these that you can stay at. But if you're looking for kind of a cheap, you know, different kind of thing, Love Hotel is definitely for you. I mean, if you are traveling by yourself or you're with a group of guys or something, it's probably not something that you'd want to, a place that you'd want to stay at. But usually they're interesting to kind of check out, because you can walk in and the few places that I've been to, I guess, they have kind of a big lit up board and it shows the different rooms that are available at that time. They light up, and then when they become unavailable, the light goes off, which is always kind of interesting, because you're kind of standing there looking at what's available, and then a light will go off and you'll, oh, someone just walked in or something. And the whole place is fairly automated. You're probably not going to see any staff. I've never seen any staff. They're usually hiding somewhere. And so it's usually kind of a vending machine type thing where you stick money in and you get a key and you go and kind of, you know, do your thing, whatever you want to do at these places. So that's an interesting, unique experience. I highly encourage it. And then on the other end of the spectrum, at number eight, is to stay at a temple. And in Japan, there's this temple lodging called Shukubo. And this is obviously a very different experience than a love hotel. It offers a lot more laid-back experience, very relaxing, kind of peaceful. And it's very, what do I want to say? Like a very kind of strict schedule. You know, dinner is usually served at 6, and that entails a typically vegetarian monk's meal, something they call shojin ryori in Japanese. And then there are morning prayers at 6 a.m. and usually breakfast at 7, which again is a vegetarian dish. And shukubo are kind of like youth hostels in a way, that they have the bathroom and bathing facilities are communal. I mean, obviously separated by sex. There's guys and girls. But you don't have bathrooms in your room. And you stay in these temple rooms that don't have locks. They're just sliding paper doors that separates you from the hallway, sometimes in some places. I'm sure other places have locks. There's kind of a different scale. There's some higher end places that do have bathrooms in the room with you. This place that I stayed at, it was a separate, you have to walk down the hall to go to the bathroom and to go to the sento. It wasn't a onsen, I don't think, but a sento and things. But it's very nice and very relaxing, very quiet at night. And so it's just something to kind of clear your head, kind of experience. Usually, I just kind of doing research for this article. Typically, it costs about 9,000 to 15,000 yen a night, what I've seen now. But I remember the place that we stayed at was kind of cheaper, like 8,000 or 6,000 yen or something. So it can be a little, not reasonable, but not too expensive of a thing to do, to check out. The typical place where you can really get a taste of what a monk's life is like is in Koyasan. There are shukubo in Kyoto and Nara, but Koyasan has a lot of shukubo, and it's very much... Koyasan is very much like what I imagine Kyoto used to be. There's monks in training. You see monks walking around in the kind of city. It's not really a city. It's more like a little small village up there on the mountain. And there's a lot of beautiful buildings there and a huge graveyard. And it's more of an authentic experience than Kyoto is or Nara is. Kyoto and Nara, they're very... touristy. Those are the big places. That's where the oldest building is. That's the largest wooden structure in the world, is there. So everyone goes there in Nara. And of course, Kyoto has the Golden Pavilion, which are amazing. You should go see. But if you really want to have like authenticness, Koyasan's the place to go. And booking a shukubo is relatively easy. We booked ours, I think, online, but it's a little strange because you reserve it, and I don't think we didn't need a credit card, I think. You just reserve it in the system, and then when you get there, you pay them in cash. They usually don't deal with credit cards at these places. They're very small. Usually they only have about... you know, I think the place that we were at had maybe 10 rooms, and there were about 20 of us all together staying there. And usually there tends to be at least one monk that can speak a little bit of English. We were lucky. We had one of the monks spoke really, really good English, and he kind of helped us around and told us what's what and explained the different things. And he was just really excited, you know, that he could use his English, and, you know, really excited about telling us about the temple and everything else. So it was a good experience. Just one thing to keep in mind is that Koyasan, if you do go there, basically the entire town shuts down at around 6 p.m. So I went there, I think, a few years ago, with my wife, and we almost didn't find a place to eat dinner because we thought we would eat in town and not at the temple, because we didn't think we'd get back to the temple in time and that we were staying at. But, you know, and so we thought, oh, we'll just find, you know, a restaurant or a convenience store or something to eat something at. And literally like everything was shut down. Like you couldn't buy food anywhere. And so I think we ended up having to eat some snacks that we packed, in like drinking water out of the faucet, out of the bathroom. It was, it wasn't a good experience. So if you do go there, I would recommend getting the, usually temple has, you know, for a little bit extra, like 1,000 yen or something, you can get the dinner at the temple, which I would recommend you do, and then, you know, make sure you get back to the temple in time. Or if you want to spend more time at the graveyard or something, you know, pack a lunch, in other words. Number seven is Japanese sports. Now, the first thing that probably comes to mind when you think of Japanese sports is sumo, which is great. I mean, that's the Japanese sport. You should go, you know, if you do have the time and it's available, you should go and see sumo. But there are a lot of other sporting events you can take in as well while you're here that are, in my opinion, unique. It's like a unique experience. For example, baseball. Now, the stadiums here are generally smaller and a little more intimate than those in the States. And fans really get into the sport here, which is really different because in the States, you know, you go to the baseball game, you sit there quietly and you eat your peanuts, you shell your peanuts and eat them. And, you know, if there's a home run or a big hit or something, then you stand up and you start cheering. But in Japan, there's like ongoing cheering, like all the time. People are just always making noise and doing these synchronized cheers, and people dress up from head to toe in, you know, team wear. They have a hat and the crazy hair and, you know, the full jersey and everything to root for the team. So it's especially true for here in the Kansai area. The most popular team is the Hanshin Tigers, and you'll see a lot of people with Hanshin Tigers wear on a game day. You'll see them on the trains. They're all decked out, you know, heading towards the game. And it's usually a big game. And they have a rivalry against a Tokyo team called the Yomiuri Giants, which, and so when the Giants come to town, it's a huge game. And it's amazing if you have the chance to see that game. But anyway, every major city in Japan has a team of some kind. Actually, Kansai has two. We have the Oryx Buffaloes, I think, for Osaka, and Hanshin Tigers are actually in Hyogo, kind of just outside Osaka. So we have two teams here that play, but usually every city has at least one that you can go and watch. And there's also here in Osaka, there's also high school tournaments that are played in August and in spring. These can be especially exciting because the athletes can be a little bit more emotional because, you know, they're not pros. They're not these grizzled veterans. They're these high school kids, and they're playing in August, which is really hot in Japan and humid. And so there'll be a lot of times when, you know, they'll make mistakes. There's a lot of emotions, you know, some crying in the baseball game that takes place. So it's a lot more exciting to watch, and a lot of people enjoy those here in Japan. Another thing too is there's a very active soccer league with regular games. I haven't gone to any games, actually, soccer games, but I've heard it's really good. It's really exciting, something to check out, and there's a lot of good soccer teams here in Japan. Obviously, they don't compare to soccer teams in Europe, but they're well, definitely better than the States, something to catch. Of course, there's always sumo, but sumo tournaments kind of tour the country and can be a little difficult to go to. It's not really like you go to, you know, if you go to Tokyo or something, every weekend they have a match or something like that. It's they kind of tour around, and so it's they only have a short period of time, and you have to buy the tickets kind of quickly, and tickets can be kind of expensive sometimes for sumo. I've actually never gone because I don't really have that strong of a desire to go see it. I mean, I watch it on TV sometimes, but I don't really get into it. But I have heard it's very unique experience. It's not a stadium. There's different boxes that you can get, and you can really get the full experience for sumo. And it is interesting when the sumo tournament comes to town. The minor sumo wrestlers will take the public transit. So you'll see them on the train sometimes, just like going to work. Like I'll be going to work or somewhere, going somewhere, and you'll just see like a sumo wrestler all, you know, dressed up in his garb with his hair slicked back and everything, just hopping on the train, you know, and riding into town. That's always really interesting. So, and anyway, the sixth one is to climb Mount Fuji, or at least some mountain in Japan. Now, Mount Fuji is a symbol of Japan. It's recently been designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It always seems to make it on any to-do list for things to do in Japan. And rightfully so. It kind of stands alone from other mountains. It's not part of a mountain range. So it makes it a little bit more, you know, beautiful and majestic, even from the bottom to see it. I'm sure you've seen hundreds of photographs of Mount Fuji from different angles. But the sunrise from the top is truly amazing if you can manage to go on a day when the clouds are just right. We were really lucky when we climbed and got a really beautiful view just above the clouds, and it looks like you're flying above the clouds. It's absolutely amazing. Mount Fuji has always been a crowded mountain, though. It's and with its recent designation by the UN, because everyone in Japan really loves UNESCO sites, it has become just outrageously popular, I guess. It's so crowded that they now ask for a donation to help with the cleanup and preservation of the mountain. You don't have to pay to get on the mountain, but they just, you know, it's most people donate something on their way up to help clean it up, because it has become a little bit of a mess. The mountain has, just because there's so many people climbing that mountain every day. And so the big thing to think about, though, is if you want to do like a serious mountain climb, you'll be mistaken. It's more like a cue to the top of the mountain, because everybody moves up the mountain at a steady pace, and I mean, there are thousands of people with you. So, you know, don't go thinking you'll be able to enjoy the solitude. You're basically just kind of following the person in front of you, and the person behind you is following you, and you're just kind of worth food and drinks at ridiculously high prices in case you forget something. So it's not really like you're roughing it. The only thing that they tend to be missing is the toilet paper. There's no toilet paper on the mountain. So be sure to bring some of your own. And so in case you need to use that. And the scenery on your way up is pretty much the same. It's just black rock. Every station you stop at, you can see the station you came from and the station you're climbing to, because there's just no vegetation on the mountain. So it can be a little disheartening to struggle with the thin air for an hour just to turn around and seemingly see you really haven't traveled that far. So it's kind of a difficult, monotonous climb. It is worth it to get to the top. It's very beautiful, even what we did was we got to the top, watched the sun set, and then stayed at the cabin on the top, got up, and we saw the sun rise. So, which was really beautiful, and really amazing to see both of those. I don't know if it's actually even worth it to stay at a place because we didn't sleep at all in the cabin. And it's really, really cramped. You do not have any space in these cabins. You have like a little thin line where you're sleeping. But it was worth it. One piece of advice I'd say is be sure to get one of these cheap wooden walking sticks at the bottom of the mountain so that you can brand it at each station you stop at. They have this little hot iron that they use to burn in a mark onto the stick. So by the time you get to the top, your stick should be completely full with burnt brands. And then for bonus points, you can go down another trail that you know, a different trail than what you came up on, and you can have another set of brands burnt into the other side, like I did. Because I went up Fujinomiya, which is the main trail. It has a lot of stations. There's a lot of people climbing that trail. It's very easy because there's good solid steps. And then we went down Gotemba, which Gotemba is where the last time Mount Fuji erupted, it's kind of where all the ash blew out of is Gotemba. And so it's just a huge pile of ash. Not really ash, but like a soft rock. And not even really soft rock. It's not, I guess what I want to say is it's not padded down. So what's really cool is that you can kind of run down the mountain and jump like really high, ridiculously high into the air and land in this kind of soft, ashy stuff. And, you know, like way farther down the hill. So it's very fun to go down the hill that way, go down the mountain that way, because you can go very quickly. And there's also, when we were climbing down, there's a huge mist, so you can't see anything. I mean, you can only see about 100 feet in front of you, and then it just, you know, everything disappears. So people just kind of come out of the mist as you're climbing down, and you'd kind of run and jump into the mist and fly through the air, and it's fun. It's a fun climbing down. Climbing up is terrible, actually, because there's just a lot of people and you have headaches because of altitude sickness. And but there are plenty of other mountains in Japan. A lot of them offer some spectacular views with less people and more breathable air. So if you like to be outside a lot, I recommend looking up another mountain to try while you're here. For example, here in Kansai, Mount Ibuki in Shiga is a great climb and can be done in one day from the bottom. Ibuki is not as tall as Mount Fuji, the summit isn't, but the actual hike, if you start from the bottom, if you start from the base of the mountain, is taller. In other words, you go up higher into the air if you take that hike than Mount Fuji. So it is a pretty challenging hike, and the air is a lot more breathable. The view is pretty amazing. You're not above the clouds, but you can get a good view of Lake Biwa, which is up there in Shiga. It's the largest lake in Japan, and just kind of take it all in, and it's really good. They got a lot of shops on top. You can get some ice cream when you get up there. So it's a good hike. And there's also a list of 100 of the famous mountains in Japan that's worth a look to see if there are any mountains you want to tackle on your visit. Actually, one of my students is determined to climb every single one of those, every single one of the 100 mountains or whatever. So he tries to climb one a month, and so far he has, I think, done half, like a 50 or 60 of the mountains. So he's getting up there. So There's lots of outdoor stuff. I would recommend climbing at least one mountain while you're here in Japan. Anyway, that's it for this half. I'm going to just do the five of the top 10. I'm already at a half hour, so this is a really long podcast. So I'm going to leave it there. But if you have some time, please stop by the website. This is episode 138. You can leave me a comment here. I'd like to know, what are some other things to do in Japan that you would recommend to someone that's coming here, visiting here, living here? Can you guess what the top five things I'm going to recommend are? I'll let you know, of course, next month, but you can take a guess at it this month by visiting the website. Again, this is episode 138. Leave me a comment for this episode. And or you can click on the Contact Me button on the website and contact me that way with any JLPT question you might have or a question about Japan in general. Or if you love old-fashioned email, you can email me. It's mac@jlptbootcamp.com. Any of those three ways, I would love to hear from you. And until next time, have a good time studying. To claim your free 21-page ebook on the five biggest mistakes people make on the JLPT, as well as more tips and tricks to help you pass the Japanese language proficiency test, come visit me at jlptbootcamp.com.